Welcome to Season 7 of the HPS Cast. I'm your host, Colbert Cannon. If you're new to the pod, HPS is a global investment firm. We manage approximately $95 billion in assets for a broad range of institutional and retail investors. That capital is invested across private credit and public credit strategies. Each week, I sit down with key relationships to, partners of, and friends of the firm to learn from their experience, ask how that experience shapes their current roles, and give insights into HPS and how we operate. So with that, let's bring in our guest. Our guest this week is the CIO of a leading global insurance company's investing business. He graduated Cornell in the early 90s before starting a multi-decade globe-trotting finance career. He started in risk management at Merrill Lynch and J.P. Morgan in Asia before moving to London in the early 2000s. In 2005, he joined New York Life Investments, the investing arm of New York Life, one of the largest life insurers in the world. He's been at New York Life for over a decade and currently serves as the CIO of New York Life Investment Management. He's a longtime friend of the firm, and without any further ado, I am excited to welcome in this week's HPS Cast guest, Jay Yoon, CIO of New York Life Investment Management. Jay, welcome to the pod.
Glad to be here.
So Jay, I like to go all the way back to start. Where are you from originally? Where'd you grow up?
Yeah, so I was actually born in Korea. And around age 8, my father became an expat of a large construction company in Korea. And I spent my latter part of my elementary school and middle school in Europe, Holland, Germany, England. And then I came to America for a boarding school, high school, and then Cornell College.
Yeah, so you ended up at Cornell. Why was that the right choice for your undergrad?
Yeah, so an Asian father, my father insisted electrical engineering, of all things, is the only real education I should get. So I embarked on a Cornell engineering program, specifically electrical engineering.
So you got distracted by finance. Did you ever seriously consider electrical engineering? Was that something you thought about pursuing?
Initially, I didn't have a lot of thought other than I studied very hard to get into college. But once I was in college, I actually realized I enjoyed math. I enjoyed finance. And I discovered that I actually wanted to head to Wall Street.
What was your first job then post-college?
Yeah. So I have an interesting story behind this as well, because I came to America partly because of my father's expat program. And I didn't realize I was going to become an American, right? I kind of stumbled over to America. I didn't speak very much Korean at this point because I left Korea at age 8. And so I needed to get a job in America. And don't forget, in the early 90s, Wall Street was just recovering from recession. Jobs were hard to get. So I actually went back to get a master so I can get a sponsorship for a working visa. And then I embarked on a role at Merrill Lynch on a fixed income trading floor. I was their quant programmer.
Yeah. So tell us what that means. You know, it was sort of this quant job, this risk management job. For those less familiar, what does that actually mean?
Sure. So perhaps I should take a step back. I was green as they come. I knew technical aspects. I didn't actually even know finance in much detail. A lot of these programs that I was coding were purely math-based because fixed income is an extremely mathematical instrument. This is predating the private credit market, right? We're talking basic bond math and complexity of prepayment on a mortgage product. So for me, my core finance knowledge, which I was developing along the way, was just perfectly fine for traders to tell me what to code and what kind of calculator to make. And along the way, I learned fixed income bond math.
Tell me about how the transition to then J.P. Morgan, and was that a part of the move to Tokyo at that point, or you'd already gotten over there?
No. So, yeah, I moved to the buy side of Merrill, which was based in Princeton. And I think 94, I want to bring in 94 here because it's very relevant to today's market. So in 94, after recession, the recovery and Fed was anticipating inflation scare. We didn't experience inflation. We had an inflation concern. So Fed started to move the yield curve around, right? And there was a huge steepening and a flattening that shook the fixed income market. That caused a need for Merrill Lynch Asset Management or Investment Management to create a risk management department. Now, what does that mean? These days, risk could mean various things. For me, that was a quant research reviewing a lot of mortgage structure products. So a lot of yield lovers back then, right? Yield levels were much higher, but people were chasing yield. And a lot of our portfolios had these mortgage structures. And clearly, a lot of the portfolio managers maybe perhaps didn't have the full awareness of when Fed moves the yield curve around and it steepens and flattens severely, what it would do to those securities and impact on portfolio. So then I actually joined in 94 a risk management quant research program that gave me this experience. And then I was offered a role at JP Morgan and subsequently in Tokyo in 97.
Okay, so the move to Japan, Jay, did you want to move to Asia? Like, was that something interesting for you to have that different experience, or was that just where the best opportunity was at that time?
That was really the best opportunity. You know, I have to say, I respect my father, who asked me one question when I asked for advice. He had the one question, which is, are you comfortable where you are? And I said, yeah, I'm doing really well, and I'm extremely comfortable. He said, then move.
I love it. That's perfect advice, Jay. Okay, so we're into Japan now. We are the head of risk control Asia for JP Morgan. Is that right? For the fixed income business?
Yeah. So I didn't actually get that role. I actually went to Japan to be a desk risk manager for Tokyo fixed income. And then within 2 weeks of my arriving in Tokyo, Yamaichi Securities went bankrupt. And it was a series of situations that led to what we might not remember very well, but Asian financial crisis, okay? IMF was involved in bailing out multiple countries, including South Korea at the time, and it had implications to Japan. And ironically, in this crisis mode, I was able to manage certain risks. And I have to tell you, this is another lesson learned. A couple of the traders told me this, a very senior, and I was, 28, 29, said this, in my 20 years of trading this market, I've not seen that risk happen. It's not going to happen. And I have to tell you, it happened.
Well, and it's the death knell, right? Anytime anybody ever says that, you know, to like, you know, watch your wallet, right?
So exactly. Yeah. So I actually dealt with certain crises and I realized I wouldn't say thrive, but I actually do well during crisis management or situations where there's no perfect answer, despite I'm an engineer.
Yeah, and Jay, actually, I'm interested in that because, listen, you've been sitting in and investing in a risk management seat through multiple crises. And as you say, you've had to be successful through that. How? Like, what is it in your skill set or in your capabilities that you look at and say, okay, this is how you operate in these environments?
I think I'm pretty flexible, adaptable. People say, I think out of the box. How do you go and value certain securities, certain products when there is no market discovery? How do you make certain assumptions? There is no right answer. So you're not looking for the right answer. You're looking for a reasonable answer.
Now we're into 2005. You join New York Life Investments, where you've worked for the better part of, you know, a couple decades at this point.
Yeah.
Let's start with the basics. Before we talk about your first job there, what is New York Life Investments for those less familiar?
Yeah. So New York Life Investment Management is a wholly owned subsidiary of New York Life Insurance Company, right? The New York Life Insurance Company is the largest mutual life insurance company in the U.S., and our total asset is slightly below $700 billion. These days, markets have taken some away, right? About $400 of that is actually third-party business, New York Life Investment Management. And I'm CIO of that aspect.
So, Jay, let's talk about your career transition. You start out in risk management. You are now an investment officer. And the best investors I know have a relentless focus on risk and downside. But how do you personally learn things that you need to do on the job that you aren't as familiar with? What's your technique for coming up the curve?
So the great thing about being a macro manager is, and I like to think out of the box, I like to stay flexible and ask a lot of questions. I don't, you know, just talk to other research folks. I actually talk to everybody. I mean, like an extreme example, I'll talk to a cab driver when I'm overseas trying to get a sense for, you know, what's going on from his lens. So the beauty of being a macro manager is obviously you read a lot of people's research, but you also have to come up with your own view of the world and which pockets of the markets or asset class you actually think might add value in this environment currently or as we go forward. So for me, I love this job because every year is different. Right? Every year something else is going to provide you with the next opportunity. So I think it's that mindset of being flexible. I think the word agility comes to mind. It's extremely important.
Makes complete sense. Jay, you manage a large global team now. How has your experience working in such a broad range of different geographies helped you in your current role?
Yeah. So I'm constantly traveling and meeting different folks for purpose of investing and developing trade ideas, as well as helping them solve for what their needs are. I think the success I've had in traveling to Asia, particularly because I actually do own the business of growing Asia, is with my view on how I manage money and issues I see, I discuss and consult my clients about these issues I see, and then listen to their issues, which is helpful to me as well, personally. Because when you look at global investing is understanding each of the local markets and how they're constructed and how they're managed, and that brings us together. So global markets has implications, but to understand impact, you have to actually understand local market, in this case, Japan, which it can be very influential to our bond market here in the U.S., right?
Yeah, it makes complete sense. Well, you talked about managing through crises, and you talked about, you know, the global financial crisis having some echoes from, obviously, the Asian currency crisis. You're sitting in an investing seat in a relatively benign market in 2019, and then, of course, COVID hits. And listeners know I love the Mike Tyson quote, everyone has a plan until they're punched in the face. That was a different crisis. It was a different dynamic, and it required us to manage things differently. How did you and your seat manage through the market impact and the people impact for your business of COVID?
Yeah. So, you know, maybe this is where I'm a little more keen to left tail than right tail, because around February, because I did travel to Korea in February, and that was the beginning of COVID. And I think they had a count of 20 people infected, recorded infection when I was there, and none of us knew what that was. Some of that, I actually did start to get a sense that this could be bigger. I didn't realize how big. What I did have to self-reflect and kick myself was how extreme the right tail was, right? This massive, you know, Fed's got your back, just go, you know, go lever. There's the amount of leverage the world put on, retail included, in latter part of 2020. I actually underestimated it, I have to admit. 2020 was a tough year in the latter half because I'm a value investor. That's my style. So I had to say 2020 was a tough year.
Yeah. Well, so then, you know, we're now seeing the impact of that. We're recording this in the first quarter of 2023. Markets remain unsettled with inflation and rates both up for the first time in over a decade. How do you see the macro unfolding? How does the current situation resolve itself?
Yeah. So I've now started to do some YouTube videos for some Korean media, newspaper, economic newspaper. And I actually started to see this market pretty well. And I think one thing I wanted to share with everyone is it's so important to understand history, right? And for me, history or experience rather is 94. Some of that is relevant for today's environment, but some of the experience goes back to the 70s and 80s of inflation. I think many investors didn't quite understand coming out of Jackson Hole when Powell referenced Arthur Burns. You know, what I heard is, I don't want to be next Arthur Burns. I don't want to go down in history as the guy who screwed it up twice.
Well, if you see me looking off camera, it's because I'm smiling up at my bookshelf where I have literally textbooks about the 70s because, you know, listen, it wasn't like, I was born then, I wasn't investing then. And so I needed to remind myself of exactly right. This stuff, right? It's important.
Absolutely. I actually, you know, obviously read as you have, but I also, every time I stumble on an individual, and has to be quite late in maybe in the mid 70s, actually, quite late in their career. I met a CIO who's still working and was investing back then. And then once I meet these folks, I spend a lot of time trying to understand what they experienced. It's one thing to read. It's another thing to experience, right? It improves your thinking process.
Well, and Jay, what I love about this, and you've said this before, the best investors I know are great listeners. And I can tell, Jay, like, that's what you do, right? You synthesize all this input from everybody, and that gets you the right answer.
Yeah. And to me, I actually have been talking on a lot of these YouTube videos about, not so much about what to buy and what to sell and what timing, but I'm trying to educate them about history, what's relevant and why it's important for Powell to reference Arthur Burns, and why you have to be respectful that, you know, rate might continue to, Fed fund rates, that is, continue to head higher. I've got 5.5 as my thought as of now.
We agree with that. Yeah. And the implications of that are profound for the markets and for everything.
And by the way, you know, you need to get these people's attention. So I coined this phrase, I think it was March when I got really loud about it. FANG is dead. And if you were working in late 90s, there was a concept called BRIC that defined these emerging countries, the four major ones, right? Rick died in early 2000, and Fang's, I'm declaring Fang is dead as of, like, I think it was March, April video.
Yeah, which was right.
I got a lot of hate mail.
Yeah, exactly. Right, up until the point that you're right. Well, let me ask you, this is obviously a personal question, given the line of business that our company is in. But, you know, we've seen this explosive growth in private credit. Per Preqin, it was a roughly $100 billion asset class, 08-09. It's over a trillion today. When you overlay your macro perspectives and what's going to happen, what's your perspective then on private credit as an asset class at this point in the market cycle?
I guess that's why I got this invite, because I said, as I look at 2023 and maybe four, I'm not so sure equity valuation, public or private, will fare as well. And every single strategy is drawing a V in public, right? And privates have correlations to public. So I actually, and beating the drum beats about high yield private credit, the yield advantage, we might see highly volatile or fairly volatile sideways market in equity as we discover Fed taming inflation. So, you know, in a 60-40 portfolio, I even want to thematically take 10% of the 60 that's in equity and just plop it in high yield.
Yeah. And just expand on that a little bit for me. When you think about the relative value between the two of them, you mentioned sort of choppier markets and equities. Why? Like, draw that comparison, because I think this is interesting.
Yeah. So if I had to build a portfolio today and I can't open it till end of the year, right? We know we're going to draw some form of V, not or bunch of Ws, right? It's going to be volatile, but I think it's fairly sideways market. In that sideways market, if I look at just pure S&P 500 or equity index versus high yield. In high yield, what you're going to get something that's priced at $85 on a basket that, you know, so you get some of that price benefit and protection on the downside. You get about, what, 9% coupon? You know, let's go give or take and not split hairs. In equities, you get like a 4.5% dividend, and you might get 0% price return. Just go sideways. Now, that's my base case, or that's the Wall Street's base case, right? Wall Street strategies got anywhere from 3,600 to 4,200, throwing away the extreme strategies, okay? That's the range. That's sideways market, frankly. If things get a lot worse and we go down severely, then what's the problem? Your high yield probably goes down with a beta of about half. It's already trading at $85, right? Then sell your high yield and buy equity.
How do you think about public versus private credit as part of that analysis?
So I think private credit offers you slightly more attractive yield, so it's more interesting. Now with private, my caution to all my investors, and we have them too, the product as well as clients in them, you have to be choosy. Okay, last 5, 7, 10 years, a lot of spinoffs and new entrants to the market, and with QE behind us, last 12 years of QE, or 14 years, frankly, we've had a lot of aggressive credit investors that just bought everything, do really well.
Which worked for a decade. That's exactly right.
Yeah. I actually caution my investors, because some of their screening process, they'll pick the top quartile managers and then from there conduct due diligence. And I actually think, wow, that's like endpoint dependent performance. To me, those things are extremely dangerous.
I mean, Jay, once a quant guy, always a quant guy. I mean, you're exactly right. Yeah. Don't get me wrong. But yes, that's right.
Yeah. And right now is probably a turning point for some of this stuff, right? Yeah. QT's here. M2's contracting finally, probably in 23, right? We're going to see. We saw 28% M2 money multiplier. Okay. Now we're going to see negative number potentially, right? QT's still there lurking behind the back. Fed's hiking. You know, I'm sorry, but this is a turning point.
No, we agree.
Do not look at that. Yeah. So I say question numbers that are too good to be true.
Yeah.
Because they probably are.
No, we share the same reaction. Awesome, Jay. Well, listen, you are always and have been very thoughtful about macro. Thank you. These insights are very interesting and thoughtful for our listeners. Jay, I want to move to the last segment of our pod. It's something we like to call best ideas, where we offer up something that's added value in our life. We call it best ideas because it's our goal as investors to always maximize exposure to those. Jay, you're our guest. I'm going to ask you to go first. What's your best idea this week?
Where I've gotten so much personal gratification, satisfaction was the YouTube videos I've done. So September of 2021, a journalist, they come and interview me. But this time he brought a video. And I'm like, I'm in a golf shirt and he's like videotaping me for, I've dressed up since. I've done about, you know, I've done about a dozen of them. But you know, these are like 40, 50 minute videos. So they're not just catch somebody's attention and trade idea. This is like talking about market and history of it, right? And why Fed might behave the way it's going to behave because of history. You know, I didn't know who my audience was. It started with like 50, 70,000 viewers and got to about 200. Now, for Korea, small population, a country, small population, that's a pretty large group of investors. I mean, I had a bunch of other letters as well from people that manage money in Korea. I actually help a lot of people in their 40s that might not fully appreciate the longer history that probably was needed, right? We've seen that here in the U.S. too, right? A lot of these hedge fund investors, they've grown up with QE,
yep.
Right? And now we're in a different world, and you have to fully appreciate, you know, history and Arthur Burns and what Powell's and Fed's agenda is at the moment, right? This morning, we're reminded again, right?
I love that, Jay. I mean, I think that your mix of history, of listening, of learning, and that constant learning, your YouTube videos being perfect examples, that's great advice. Couldn't agree more. Okay, well, as listeners know, I like to be inspired by the guests of the week, and so I wanted to offer my best idea. Jay, as he has discussed, is of Korean descent, and I immediately thought about one of my favorite new-ish restaurants in New York. It's a fantastic Korean spot that all my New York listeners should check out, or for everyone else, put it on your list for your next visit to the Big Apple. My best idea this week is the remarkable Oeji Mi, which opened less than a year ago in the Flatiron neighborhood of New York. Oeji Mi is an upscale sister restaurant to the original beloved Oeji in the East Village, both run by a chef named Brian Kim. It offers a prefix five-course tasting menu, and while not cheap in an absolute sense relative to other tasting menu options in town, it's literally a bargain. The food takes Korean staples and adds some international modern twists. So think deconstructed bibimbap or bosam with foie gras. It's a stylish room, it's got beautiful food, and it's just a fantastic experience all around. So in honor of our Korean guests, I highly recommend Oeji Mi for your next high-end culinary outing. Jay, any chance you've checked out that spot yet?
I work in Flatiron, so I must check it out. Thank you.
You got to go. Yeah, it's fantastic. Well, with that, it's time to wrap up for the week. Jay, your insights are always appreciated. Sincerely, thank you for taking the time to come on the show. Always great to catch up.
Thank you very much for inviting me. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks again to our guest, Jay Yoon. Check out our show notes to learn more about Jay and his firm, New York Life Investment Management. You'll also find a link to my best idea, Oeji Mi, an upscale Korean dining experience in the Flatiron neighborhood of New York City. This podcast is brought to you by At Will Media with HPS Investment Partners. Please be sure to rate, review, and subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you like to listen. The opinions expressed on this podcast are that of the host, Colbert Cannon, and the guest of each episode, and do not necessarily reflect the views of HPS Investment Partners.